Artlist.io. Every single day I
feel the pressure. Hey, welcome back to What Are You Made Of here in That One Studio with your boy C-Rock. We're live in some cases, and some people are listening to the recording of this, and some people are watching the video. However you're consuming this, I appreciate you being here in support of the show. We got another great guest for you today. Daniel Breezy is in the building. I pronounced that right, Breezy? Breezy?
Breezy. Get out there.
Let's go. Dan's in the building, man. He's a retired professional snowboarder with 4 X Games medals who has since transitioned to multifamily real estate investing. He oversees operations, acquisitions, and investor relations at Granite Towers Equity Group, where they currently have $350 million of assets under management and $100 million of equity under management. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Hey, man, look, this show is all about the ingredients that have gone into making my guests who they are. And not only are you having success in real estate investing, which is a business, right? A lot of people just talk about real estate this, real estate that, get passive cash flow. But they don't all the time talk about the fact that it's a business. It's a type of business, right? But you've had success in this, obviously, that at the X Games and being a professional snowboarder, a lot of stuff has probably gone on behind the scenes that nobody knows about and nobody's seen for you to have this success. And that's what we want to explore today. So I'm interested in this question. What are you made of, Dan?
I would say the one thing that would describe me is persistence or grit. You know, just being very clear on what the goal is and then just not backing down.
Yeah, I've noticed a common theme with every successful person I've ever met and talked to. It's that they just didn't quit. They didn't stop. It's like they just have this thing where it's like, I'm getting there. I just have to go through some things and data collect off my failures and whatever. But how did you get into snowboarding? Was it a passion as a kid? And then you maybe started skiing first, or like where did that all start? What's the story behind that?
Yeah, no. So I was very athletic as a kid. I really loved sports. I did a bunch of the team sports, baseball, football, basketball. And I don't know, my timing wasn't quite right. You know, this was before puberty. I was a little kid yet trying to figure it out. And I kind of got pushed around. And one day my cousin from, he lived just south of us, a friend from California, brought a snowboard into town. And because this is when snowboarding wasn't very well known yet, it was pretty new. So not many people had them in Minnesota. So this kid from California comes in and he has a snowboard. And we tried it out in my cousin's backyard, and what it was just extremely fun. So for the next few years, it really was more of a, I love doing this. Let's just go and ride as much as we possibly can. And after 3 years or so, 4 years of riding every day, just because it was so much fun, I started to improve at a faster pace than most other guys that were there. I started to see that I had a little bit of a natural ability to it. I got better than my brother. I got better than his friends. And my brother was older than me. So there was, older brother years, you always want to be like them. And all of a sudden you're riding at a higher level. So, one thing just led to another. It wasn't just like, boom, I want to be a pro snowboarder. It evolved, you know? But once that goal was clear, I still can remember the day I was about 15 years old, where I basically said from here on out, everything I do is going to be committed to achieving this goal. And the goal was very clear. There were professional snowboarders out west, and I grew up in Minnesota. So these guys lived in Salt Lake or Colorado, and there were videos, and these guys were big known athletes from creating these movies, these video parts. So it was very clear, like, that's where I want to go. That's what I want to do. That's what's who I want to be. So from about 15 on, it was just 100% commitment. And, you know, I wasn't the kind of kid where my parents hooked me up with everything and, you know, said, yeah, we'll move you to Vail and we'll put you in a private school and we'll pay for everything. It was basically I love my parents more than you could ever imagine, right? Every kid does. But they didn't have the money to say, here you go. It was 100%. Like, you want to figure this out, you're going to have to work. And so that was a big challenge too for me, coming from small town Minnesota, of how do you move out west? And because snowboarding is expensive. You need the gear. You need the season pass. You need all this product. So that was something that was a challenge. But, you know, when you want something, you're clear on what you want, you'll find a way. You'll always find a way.
Yeah. I mean, were you ever a skateboarder or no?
Yeah, a little bit. It was part time here and there, but I really love the speed of snowboarding and being able to fly off the jumps. I mean, skateboarding is a great sport, but man, it's brutal on the body and it's more technical. Whereas snowboarding, gosh, you can come in at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour and hit a jump and fly 70, 80, 100 feet through the air. So it's just a different feel.
Yeah, I'll say. So do you remember your first time going on something like a really difficult slope? And like, holy, like, did you ever feel ever in this journey, feel like you were like a little bit of, you know, underwater with it or no?
Oh gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were times where I felt overwhelmed. I mean, when I first moved to Colorado, I realized, my gosh, I thought I was going to move to Colorado. I moved to Colorado my senior year of high school. I was able to figure out something, a jimmy rig something with someone who lived in Vail, Colorado. And I went to school part-time and snowboarded every day during the day. And then after that, I moved to Salt Lake City with four buddies who all wanted to be professional snowboarders. We all drove from Minnesota to Salt Lake. But getting to the mountains and seeing what it was like in comparison to growing up in central Minnesota at Powder Ridge was extremely eye-opening, in the sense of I thought I'd move out there and be a pro snowboarder within a year or two. And it ended up taking full 4 or 5 years, 5 years of dedicated grind, sacrifice, 100% focus before I was at a point where I could actually ride at the level of the other pro riders and land in Powder. So it was constantly overwhelmed, feeling like, you know, this is way harder than I thought it would be.
And you guys, like, is there a way to practice? You know how like a scene, I don't know who it was, Tony Hawk and them, they had those foam pits and everything. They practice different things and they go into a foam pit versus, you know, being in a live situation. Is there a way to do that with snowboarding? Like, how do you guys practice the moves and stuff?
There is.
Without breaking things on.
Yeah, more so now there are these foam pits where you can drop in on a ramp and you have it strapped to your feet and your wheels. But the way we did it was always just powder. You'd go into the backcountry after it snowed a foot or two and you'd build a jump and you'd have 5 or 6 tries before that, you know, was bombed out. So I think really the best way to learn that kind of stuff is trampolines and then visualization. And if you got the trampoline and visualization, now you can use the foam pits. But after you're riding constantly, if you're riding every day and you're visualizing these tricks every day and you're using foam pits, you can learn these tricks at a pretty rapid pace right now.
And what did it really take? Like, how many hours of practice? Like, nobody sees this stuff, right? Like, nobody sees what a professional goes through and has to put into it. Like, what did you know, how much time did it really take per day, or, and what other exercises and things did you have to do to prepare?
Yeah, from let's just call it 11 to 21. I started when I was 11. I turned pro at 21, or really started to travel and get paid at 21. The first, I would say, 3 years, I probably rode, you know, 150 days. And then after that, I rode 180 days a year. And it's all I did. You know, it's all like everything I did was for the snowboarding, whether it was working to create an income to go snowboarding or riding. I would say the last 5 years of being in Salt Lake City, you know, our typical day was we'd ride from about 9 until 1 or 2 in the afternoon. We'd come down, we would go to a park, local park, and we maybe hit a handrail, and then we'd go film something until sometimes 10, 11 at night, and then you'd repeat. So because a lot of the stuff we're doing, a lot of the stuff I was more known for was urban riding. X Games came out with this new event called Real Snow. They came out with skateboarding called Real Street. For dirt biking, it's called Real Moto. And for snowboarding, it's called Real Snow. And when that event came out, I was at the pinnacle of my urban part of my career. And I was known in the sport. So I got invited. I was one of the 5 guys to be invited to the first Real Snow event. And during that time, when you're putting that stuff together, you're literally working around the clock. You're running on 5 to 6 hours of sleep. That's all you're doing. So there's times where you're more obsessive, but you're never not. You know, I listen to some of the Kobe Bryant talks he talks about on his way up. You're never not putting on the gas. You're never not pushing it. You're always thinking about it. And, you know, it's interesting, too, that I found interesting when I was younger, I had this massive obsession for snowboarding. And a lot of my friends were into it, but they were not like me. And I remember being like, man, what's up with me? Like, they're into it, but then they're like, they're done. They want to go and play video games. And I'm like, I'm not ready to be done, A. And when I'm done, I want to go watch snowboarding videos. So I'm obsessively all over it. But once I got to the level of other guys who were getting paid, they were all just like me.
That obsession was there. Yeah. Yeah.
They all had the same obsession. That's all they talked about. That's all they thought about. That's all they wanted to do. So I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's your obsession becomes your reality.
And was as Sean White was with you when you were doing it, or
he would be at events and we'd compete every now and then. I didn't hang out with the guy regularly, but yeah, he'd be at events all the time.
But I mean, was that be like around the same time, or was he before you or after? Okay, same time.
Yep, same similar time.
Gotcha. And then what, like, you mentioned something about shooting content, right? Like, how big was content, like the importance of it in becoming professional and becoming marketable, so to speak? Because I talk about, you know, these kids have these NIL deals now in college and even high school now, believe it or not, like football players, basketball players. And like so many of them have no idea how to market themselves and become push content out on Instagram and different places, right? But like, was that a big part of it to become pro and then to get become marketable? Is that why you were shooting the content?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in order to kind of come up as a snowboarder, you're coming up in one of two ways. You're either going to shoot video footage and take photos, or you're going to compete. And growing up in small town Minnesota, there aren't many big name contests, and it's hard to show up at a half pipe contest or a slope style contest and just dominate if you grew up in Minnesota. So most athletes out of Minnesota, most snowboarders are going to be filming video parts. So you're in most of the stuff in Minnesota is urban. Again, you're growing up in a small flat, small hills, flat area, not a lot of snow. So we were filming video parts, and you'd film urban is what we had. So that's really what our strength was and what we would focus on. And most of the guys that are coming out of Minnesota that turn pro are generally stronger urban riders than backcountry, just because of the terrain you're growing up on. We were shooting video every year. I mean, you were trying to make a video part. That's all the goal was every year, was let's create the most powerful video part you could create. At the end of the year, your footage comes out. It comes out on a VHS or DVD at the time.
Damn.
I went to the VHS, to the DVD, to just online. Now, my last video parts were only online, just like everybody else's. But, that's all you were doing, is creating content to market for yourself and the brands that you're supporting you. Because when you start out as a pro snowboarder, you're not all of a sudden getting a paycheck. They start you with product. They're like, hey, here's a few snowboards. Here's a couple of pairs of bindings. Here's some outerwear. Go wear it. Let's see what you can do next year. You know, so it's not just this straight to the top. It's a slow process.
Yeah. And besides pay and product and things, like, what were some of the perks that you got becoming a pro snowboarder? And what were your favorite things that came along with it?
I would say probably the biggest perk was just travel. You know, you had brands paying for you to travel all over the world to ride at the best locations in the best snow. I mean, all you were doing was chasing storms. You know, towards the end of my career, when it was more backcountry, it would literally just be, hey, what storm just hit where? Let's book tickets and fly there and be in the best, you know, best snowboarding conditions you could possibly ever imagine. Or a lot of it was, we go to Whistler with snowmobiles and just being out in the backcountry with your friends snowmobiling all day. I mean, really, all these guys were young, just like us. And you know, you're all in the same boat. You're young guys looking to have fun and snowboard. So, you got paid well, and you had pretty much everything taken care of. You didn't really have to worry about anything. They planned your travel. You were just there to do one thing, and that was snowboard, which is really a unique perspective.
And did they have groupies? What do they call them? Snow bunnies or something? I don't know. Was there people like that, you know, traveled around with you guys, like, or followed you guys? Whether
no,
it was groupies, I mean, or fans, or
no, it was just our filmers and photographers that would travel with us. We were filming. No, we didn't have people traveling with us at all.
Oh, I didn't know if they not traveled with you directly, but like knew where you guys were going to be and then showed up there. And I didn't know if that came along with
it. No, usually it would just be for if you're in a contest, there'd be people there. Obviously, a lot of people there. Or if you have a video part, when you create a movie, you'd have a video premiere tour. So you'd go around all over the world and you tour with the movie. And so when you'd show up at the movie theaters, there would obviously be people there. But no, it wasn't big enough in the States here where if you were traveling, they were just following you. It wasn't like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what's the biggest adversity you dealt with in your career, in the snowboarding career?
I would just say injury, you know, just mental challenge of you get knocked down and realizing, you know, I had my first knee injury, and when I had my first knee injury, I just assumed it would be like any other injury, that it would just heal on its own. And I did enough damage, and I was young and naive enough where I didn't get it checked out and didn't do the proper work, and it just didn't heal. And my knee never would have worked right again without a surgery. So, and when I did have the surgery, it was a full 10 month, 11 month, 12 month, a year recovery before I was 100%. So, you know, just that And that happened before I started getting paid. So you're grinding. Like, you just imagine you're trying to get to a point where you're trying to make a career. You're missing college because you're so committed. I mean, there were some kids who tried to do college and try to snowboard, but they never really had a huge career. Then it didn't seem to be ever really a major athlete in the sport. So I'm committed 100%, missing the college life. Friends are all doing it. And then you're 20, 21, and you get a knee injury, and all of a sudden you've got another year off, and your brands at that time are thinking, damn, this kid's good, but he's got a knee injury at 21. He's got to come back from that. Then we got to start to market him. So I think that if I wasn't committed at 21 when I had my major knee injury, I would have quit. But you know, I looking back to it, there was never a time in my mind where I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to keep going. It was just like, get on my bike. Let's get healed up and get back to it. And you know, the next year things took off.
Yeah. So before I get into the real estate stuff and how you transitioned into that, I talked to you a little bit in the green room about this, and this is something I've been really paying attention to over the last few years about not identifying with what you do, but like find out who you are and then what you do is your vehicle. Right. And a lot of athletes I noticed deal with this. I was an athlete in college, played football, and a lot of the pro athletes and friends of mine, I know, like, they've identified with what they've done. And then when the thing goes sideways or whatever, then they're lost. Did you deal with that and experience that yourself?
Yeah. I mean, what you just talked right there is the most important thing for any athlete when their career winds down, because like you just said, all I was, everything I was, the only thing I was my snowboarding career. And that's, once that is leaving or you start to see it leaving, it's scary, because what the heck else am I going to do to have this kind of passion, this kind of income, this kind of freedom, this kind of celebrity status? You know, you're like, you're nobody now. And unfortunately, most guys and gals go through a very horrendous, they lose their car, break up relationships, suicide. A couple of our buddies committed suicide. And I just wish I could talk to them, because gosh, that was so when I was midway through my career, I got to know a lot of my hero friends who lived in Salt Lake City, and their careers were about 7 to 10 years in front of mine, and they were winding down. And so when I saw that wind down happening, it scared crap out of me, and I saw what was happening in their lives. So that's one thing that I was like, okay, if I'm lucky enough to have half a long career as these dudes, I got to start doing something with my money now. I got to start figuring out what I'm going to be doing in 5, 7, 8 years when the wind down happens, so I'm not experiencing what they're going through, because what they were going through was terrifying. So that was really the look into, okay, I'm making decent money. What can I do with it to create multiple streams of income? And that's where real estate kind of started to take my attention.
And then what was the first thing that got you into real estate? What did you see? Who told you about it? Or
yeah, first thing that really hit me was, you know, like I said, I grew up in central Minnesota, and I live paycheck to paycheck, and all of a sudden I'm making decent money, and I got a tax bill that's a heavy six-figure tax bill. And in snowboarding, you get it all. So like an athlete, like, they don't take out 40% or 50%, whatever the bill would be. You just get it all, and then they ask for it back at the end of the year. And when my CPA was like, yeah, you owe $150,000 in taxes, my stomach hit the floor. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I just risked my life the last 10 years. I'm risking my life here. I got to give you 50% of what I was making last year or whatever it would be. And so that's where I was like, there's got to be a better way. And so I started reading every book I could find on taxes and what to do and how to, you know, use the tax law to do what the government wants you to do to pay less in tax. And I came across a book called Tax Free Wealth, came across a company called Provision out of Arizona, flew out to meet with them, interviewed them, hired them, and started working with them. And that was when they were like, hey, if you can start to buy multifamily property, small apartments, and your wife, who my girlfriend at the time, but turned my wife very shortly after that, could qualify as a real estate professional. Now you can use some of this to depreciation to reduce your tax bill legally. So that was really the jump.
Yeah. And then so doing that from the beginning though, like a lot of people, yeah, oh, that sounds great, but like, where do I start? Like, what was your first start into it?
Yeah. I read a book, Tax-Free Wealth was it Rich Dad?
No, but I mean, like, what was your first entry into real estate?
Oh, I see.
Did you buy a property or?
Gotcha. Yeah. I bought a duplex and I bought a nineplex. And then I bought a 24 unit deal and just started small, started slow. I love reading and I love learning. So I did most of that on the side. I didn't really know what I was doing that well at the time, but it was only my money. So. Yeah, just started with that.
And did you have any, like, did you run into any situations where you got jammed up in your first real estate deals or?
Yeah, I got lucky because of my timing. You know, my first real estate deal I bought in 2012. And at that time, the market bottomed and was just recovering. And cycles control it. Cycles are the most powerful thing in real estate for investing. We're seeing, you know, and the cycle bottomed and it was starting to come back up. So I got really lucky. And I didn't really have any issues in any of those first three deals just because the market was improving. And I bought and made good money on those deals and saw the depreciation and saw the cash flow. So had it not been that time, more than likely it would have been a hard lesson learned.
Yeah. Yeah. And then how did you get involved with Granite Towers? Is this your company or is it a group of you or how would it tell us about that?
Yep. So after I bought those first few deals, a good friend of mine who I grew up with was buying single family homes in Minnesota. And his goal was to buy like 50 or 100 homes. And he came out to visit us and I said, hey, maybe we shouldn't buy an apartment together. Let's buy a 20, 25 unit deal together. So we ended up buying one together and both liked it and just kind of kept going there. We bought another 45 unit deal and then we started our company together, Granite Towers Equity Group, Mike and I. I've known Mike since I was 10, 11 years old. We snowboarded together. I went off and had my snowboarding career. He went off and sold insurance to high net worth clients. And then we came back together. And we started the company in 2017 and the rest is history.
And have you created funds as well? And are you syndicating?
Yeah. Yeah. So every deal we buy, we create a fund and we open the fund and then close the fund just per deal. So it's not like a bunch of properties in one fund. It's one-to-one. But yeah, that's exactly how we do it. It's a syndication model. We only do 506Bs, which just means we have pre-existing relationships with people. So we've got to get to know you before we can take your capital. But yeah, that's the model.
Yeah. So, and then have you seen your obsession with snowboarding transfer into this? Has it picked up into the, yeah.
100%. I mean, people, I get calls from people in the snowboarding industry checking in and how are things going? And they're asking me if I saw this kid or this video part. And I'm like, I don't even know who that kid is. So, you know, like I was 100% in snowboarding and now I'm 100% in our business here. And you have to be now. I mean, you're taking serious capital from a lot of people. And if you're not 100% in, you really shouldn't be here in this space because it's a very serious matter. So that's where I'm at now.
And so what are you seeing like right now with the market? I was in the mortgage real estate space for 20 years. So, I mean, you know, obviously interest rates are ridiculous right now compared to where they were, eating into cash flow. Cap rates are lower. Like, what are you guys seeing right now as far as, you know, on your daily basis? And then how are you guys, I guess, like proceeding right now? Are you still looking for deals? Are you building cash? Like what's the deal?
Yeah. So if you're buying right now, you're buying deals at a very discounted price, which is great. So if you can buy, which a lot of people cannot because it's very difficult to source equity. A lot of people, it's so interesting to see sitting at a front row seat now. You know, when Warren Buffett says, when people are fearful, be greedy. When people are greedy, be fearful. And the time to have been fearful was in 2021, late 2021, early 2022, all of 2021, really, early 2022. People were so greedy and you should have been so scared. You should have been so cautious and you should have been selling. And now when people are terrified and they don't want to invest, you should be buying. Now buying right is key with the right debt. You know, we use Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac debt, 7-10 year fixed debt. So as long as we can get to a place of cash flow every month on what we're buying, we feel comfortable and confident that with the pullback we've seen, we're seeing 20 to 30% pullbacks in pricing. So we just bought a deal that was closed at $32,750,000 and 18 months ago, it sold for about $40 to $42 million. So when you see a discount like that, and you can get into fixed debt and you can get into cash flow day one. Now we can ride this cycle back. Cause remember, cycles are everything. Cycles control everything. And once you understand where you are in these cycles, now you can set up your deal and your debt to ride the cycle. And that's where it's at. So for people who are scared to invest right now, I would get it more educated. Use your education to help you feel more comfortable and confident. So that's kind of how we're doing it right now is we're looking for the cherry pick deals because there's not many people who can buy. So if you can buy, your offer is one of a few at the table. Whereas in 2021, there might've been 30 or 40 offers. I mean, that's no exaggeration. we sold a bunch of stuff in 2021, and there were so many offers. It was unbelievable. It was so easy to liquidate. And now you try to sell the same deal, it's just not going to happen. Or it's going to be a way discounted price.
Yeah. Do you think that the banks are going to, or Fannie and Freddie or whoever's holding these the debt, and then when the rate changes, do you think they're going to work with people? Because listen, like one thing I know about the real estate, they're in business with you. It's not like, you know, you owe money, this and that. Like you're partners with the bank or whoever owns the debt, right? So you think they're going to work with people more so versus people having to really discount their prices?
Yeah, I know we're already seeing that happen firsthand with bridge lenders. So these lenders that had variable short-term loans, short-term notes that are coming due with large enough portfolios, they are helping and they are adjusting. So I know that is happening. I don't think it's necessarily beneficial for the general partner team because they basically wipe out your equity as ownership and take control of the deal, but they're at least not putting you into bankruptcy and taking the deals back. So it's a better scenario, I think, than the alternative. I'm curious to see how Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac handle it because they're longer term debt where it's fixed. So it's not as abrupt and it's not as painful. And I'm curious to see where interest rates go over these next 18 months. You know, the Fed obviously is talking about these four 25 basis point reductions in 2024. And so will that continue? Will there be more of that? You know, generally, when you look at the history of it, they say they lower, they have to cut a lot faster than they generally say they do. So if that does happen, I think you see a lot of refinancing and a lot of kind of starting back up, if you will, because right now there's just not much activity in real estate.
Yeah. And when you guys raise money first and then go find a deal, like you start this fund and then, or do you find a deal and then raise money?
That's correct. Yeah. We've always found the deal. We have our investors in our database that are, you know, looking for opportunity. So we go find the deal, figure out why we like the deal. Then we bring the deal to our investors. So we have about a 60-day window to raise the capital.
Gotcha. And what rates are you seeing right now? Because by the way, I exited the mortgage business in April. So I try to get as far away from it right now because it's just one of them things. I was just traumatized by the business. But what kind of rates are we seeing, like 7 to 10 year fixed?
Yeah. So if you're in Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac debt right now, I think the 10 years at like right around a 4.9. So if you add 150 to 180 bits on top of that, let's just call it a 5.8-ish, 5.9. Somewhere in there is probably where you are for 7 to 10 years fixed. You know, we only deal in that space. So we're connected to the 10-year, 7-year more so than, you know, the SOFR and 30-year. So just, that's where we're at.
So, I mean, it's still not bad. It's just not as good as it used to be, but like, you know, single family homes, you know, when they're doing 30-year fixed and all that, they're doing like 7, they were even as high as 8 and 8s and all that. So different story. But, now podcasting, you have a show.
Yeah, we do. We have a show called Keeping It Real Estate. You bet.
Keeping It Real Estate. And how long have you been doing that now?
Gosh, I think we started it in maybe like 2021. So just 2.5 years or so. I think we're on episode 113 or 114.
Now, I always like to ask this question for the podcast hosts, like, what has it done for you personally? Yeah. And also, what have you seen it do for your business? Having a podcast?
Yeah, the thing I love most about that podcast is I get to go straight into conversations like this with people that you normally aren't going to have. You're not going to just start talking about this kind of stuff. So it allows you to go deep really quickly and hear some really amazing stories. So that's been the thing that I've enjoyed most of it. Hopefully we're bringing some really great content for our listeners and educating. I'd say one thing that we hear a lot of is our investors who do start to invest with us feel like they know us really well because they can go back and listen to 100 episodes and they start to hear who we are, how we respond to our guests. And they're like, oh, wow, now I know more about Dan or now I know more about Mike. So it gives them a chance to get to know us a lot better.
Yeah, I love it. And then have you been going on shows like this consistently as a guest?
Yeah, probably. And not as much as I probably should. I probably do, I don't know, 15 or 20, maybe 30 a year.
Okay. And have you noticed something with guesting too? Like, has it been
impactful? Yep. There are definitely, we have investors, you know, coming to our database because they heard Mike or I on a podcast. We've advertised on one podcast in the snowboarding industry, which was pretty dang beneficial. Biggest snowboarding podcast there is. We put a little real estate blip on there because folks know who I am. So that was cool. But yeah, I should probably be doing more of it.
Yeah, yeah, I love it, man. I it's changed my life. Podcast has changed my life and business, and I preach about it all the time because I'm that kind of guy. When I find something that works, I've become evangelistic about it, obsessed about it. So, but yeah, man. Hey, Dan, thank you so much for being here, brother. It's really refreshing to see the transition and then the identity topic. I think I'm going to write a book. I've already wrote this book, Rocket Fuel, back here, but I think my next book is Who Am I? And it's going to be about that. And I want to work with athletes specifically when they first get into it, right? And then that way it's not something that they got to figure out later on. I just have this thing. It's inside of me that I don't know. So yeah. I appreciate you talking about that and being transparent and vulnerable with that.
Yeah. Yeah, you bet. I'm glad I could come on, and I appreciate the time.
All right. Hang tight while I wrap this up. Guys, thanks so much for joining us here on the What Are You Made Of show from That One Studios. It's your boy, C-Rock. And until next time, be that one.